Hey, it's Kristen. You're listening to Rational in Portland. Toni Morse is running for city council in Portland in District 4. Toni, welcome to Rational in Portland.
Thanks, Kristen. Great to be here.
So we have a personal history. Gosh, I think I met you when you were still in law school? Were you a summer?
I was a summer associate at Bullivant Hauser in 2007.
So you would still have been in law school then?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then we ended up both working at Bullivant Hauser. You sold me the house I'm in now.
Mm-hmm.
And then you started this career as a advocate in mm-hmm. Oregon Recovers. And we were just talking earlier about your recovery journey, and I actually don't know much about it. So to the extent that you can you talk at all about personally how you ended up on a recovery journey and how that led you to work with Oregon Recovers?
Sure, happy to. So for your listeners, Toni Morse here. I'm a candidate for Portland City Council District 4. And for those of us who are still getting caught up to speed on charter reform, District 4 is the entire west side of Portland plus lower southeast Portland. So neighborhoods on the east side like Selwood, Westmoreland, Eastmoreland, Reed, and a sliver of Woodstock, which is where I live. And I am, to your point, a person in long-term recovery. I've been in recovery for about 7.5 years now, trained as a lawyer, went on to work as a real estate agent in Portland for about 10 years, and sharing in a general way, as we'd say, I am someone who has a personal history with addiction, and it actually sort of coincides with the time that Donald Trump was elected president, was when I was kind of nearing the end of how things were going. And I was reaching a point where I had to make a choice. I could continue one way and that didn't have a future, or I could try something different, which was recovery. And that has led me down this path of becoming more politically active. And then also through my political work, connecting with folks who do recovery advocacy. And in 2023, I became the policy and advocacy director for Oregon Recovers. And Oregon Recovers, for anyone who is not familiar, is an organization focused on solving the state's addiction crisis. And a lot of the work I was involved in was statewide policy that was being addressed in Salem. And in 2023, that looked like, obviously, a lot of discussion around Measure 110. What needed to happen with Measure 110, and what role was it going to play in solving the state's addiction crisis? So that, to some extent, involved conversations about funding and how to tune it up administratively and make it more effective. It also included things like working on the fentanyl education bill, Senate Bill 238. And beyond that, kind of a mishmash of public health and behavioral health issues we would weigh in on.
And to the extent you're comfortable with it, can you please tell us about your recovery journey? Because I think it may resonate with listeners out there.
Sure.
And
sure.
There may be people, I mean, likely there are, you know the data better than I do, but my guess is there are people listening who may be struggling themselves.
Sure. I mean, I am somebody who, I mean, I guess clinically we can say somebody with alcohol use disorder, and 7.5 years in recovery. Now I'm able to say it's in remission. And for a long time, I lived with that, and you could say it was unmanaged. And there's this expression in recovery that we have where you talk about how things are working for you just fine right up until they don't. And a lot of what can go wrong for somebody struggling with addiction is they begin to experience consequences. They can have professional consequences. Maybe things aren't going well at work, personal consequences, relationships, family members are, the relationships there have a strain on them because of the role addiction is playing. And for some people, there are legal consequences, and somebody can wind up being involved with the justice system. For me personally, the external consequences had more to do with personal relationships. And I mean, I mentioned this on my campaign website. I was at risk of losing my marriage, and that was the external pressure for me personally to really rethink and ultimately refocus how I lived. And from there, I got into recovery. And addiction, I mean, this is another recovery-ism that are really helpful. And addiction is sometimes described as giving up everything for one thing, and recovery is giving up one thing for everything. And 7.5 years later, I get to live this really full life that includes all kinds of colleagues and friends and people I know from policy and politics, and just really exciting relationships with people who are involved in making the addiction crisis something we can come together and solve. So it's really a gift, I think, to get to the point where recovery replaces addiction and you get to find ways to pay it forward.
And then how did you channel that journey into a position at Oregon Recovers? And I would say to anybody listening, if you don't know much about Oregon Recovers or the organization, go back and listen to the episode with Mike Marshall, because Mike Marshall is the head of this Oregon Recovers organization, and it might give you some context. And plus, I just think it's a really fantastic interview. But Tony, how did you end up translating that personal journey to what sounds like it would have been meaningful work?
Sure. Excuse me.
But also brave, because you're really putting yourself out there in this public way as somebody in recovery.
So I think for me, it's important to talk about the intersection between recovery and political work. And we remember in 2022, when Roe v. Wade was overturned, that was a very big deal for a lot of us. And I am someone who cares a lot about access to reproductive health care. And up until that point, I'm somebody who had done some political volunteer work, but I had never worked full time as someone who is involved in campaigns, or I should say I've never been involved on the professional level, just as a volunteer. So Roe v. Wade, though, was this moment for me where, number one, I felt called to go out and actually participate in a peaceful protest. And what that looked like was go downtown and meet up with some other people who felt the same way. And it was just that. It was a peaceful protest. It was a group of people who marched from point A to point B downtown. And I was walking with women pushing strollers. Somebody had a golden retriever with them. And it was really about coming together and making your presence and voice heard in a civil and peaceful way, just to say, hey, we don't like this. This is not okay. This is not in line with our values, and we want to make that known. And from there, I was connected with a friend who really encouraged me to apply for a job with the Democratic Party of Oregon. And ultimately, I was offered that position, and I became what's called the field organizer, and worked the entire general election cycle in 2022 to do things like recruit volunteers for door knocking and phone banking, would run canvas events, would train volunteers, would knock doors and make phone calls myself. And That, of course, was when Tina Kotek was running for governor and Christina Stevenson was running for labor commissioner. And really, everything we did was in support of electing the Democratic ticket in Oregon. From there, elections always end. They're like a baseball season, right? And election workers go on to do different things. And I, along the campaign trail, met Mike Marshall, and we obviously had recovery in common, had the fact that we'd worked in politics in common as well. And one thing led to another, and he offered me the position of policy and advocacy director with Oregon Recovers.
I mean, that's a real compliment and a testament to you, I think.
Oh, thank you.
So you are no longer with Oregon Recovers. What are you spending your time doing? Are you campaigning full time?
Campaigning full time, which is a full time job. There is always something to do on the campaign trail. And what I like about it is I get to have conversations with folks who are really interested in the future of Portland and want it to succeed. And I mean, Kristen, I know that you are somebody who cares a lot about our city, and I think your listeners certainly appreciate that you're willing to talk about what hasn't been working over the past few years and the need to think about doing things differently.
Yeah, and what can.
Right, and what can
happen. Or what we know does. You know, I mean, somebody pointed out, I think it was Daniel DeMello, who's running for city council, pointed out that, look, we just don't have to go far to figure out what works. We can walk over county lines to Clackamas or Washington anytime we want.
Sure. I mean, we do
That's a great point for a lot of things, not just on homelessness issues, but addiction too.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, we do have neighbors nearby that we can look to for different ways of doing things. But I think before we even get into geography, one thing I like to talk about with politics and our political spectrum and what it looks like is, if you imagine like a football field and you have the 50-yard line right at center field, and then if you imagine the opposing 40-yard lines, and if you put most voters, or if you back up and if you look at where most voters are on the political spectrum, they're somewhere between those two opposing 40-yard lines. Not everybody is going to agree with one another on everything, but if you look at the areas of disagreement, there's not a lot of space between people within that space. Now, by contrast, if you go out to the opposing 20-yard lines, there are fewer people out there, but with social media and other tools available, you can make yourself out on the 20 look a lot more influential than you really are. Or I guess I should say, you can make your perspective appear more in line with what most people think. And that's not true. Most people are between the 40s. And I think that to the extent we want to talk about what's going on in Portland, folks want an approach to their government that reflects that space between the 40s. They don't want extreme positions that you might find out on the opposing 20-yard lines. And what I am doing with my campaign is, I think, setting the stage for governing between the 40s. And I have gone out and earned the endorsements of a broad spectrum of folks who are involved in the community and in elected office. I'm very proud to be endorsed by Nathan Vasquez, and I'm also endorsed by Willie Chotson, who next year is going to be the only public defender in Salem as a state representative. So I am really focused on, like I said, that space towards the center where you can work as a consensus builder, someone who can put together coalitions and help lead more from the middle, where you can be reflective of what most people are looking for in their government right now.
And what do you think you bring to that specifically that will enable you to land in the middle? Because of course, I mean, I think the majority of people in Portland, yeah, I think they're reasonable people, and I don't think they are extremists, but I also think they tend to have differing opinions about how we should go about governing from the middle, or how we should go about engaging in some kind of reasonable policy. So, you know, for instance, there are some people who think the Joint Office of Homeless Services should not get checks from the city anymore. You know, Mingus Maps would be one of those people. And I thought he was really brave for voting against that. And in my opinion, I don't think that Multnomah County should get money anymore from the city. It's going to millions of dollars worth of things like needles. And I looked through that budget. I don't know if you looked at it. In that Multnomah County budget, I didn't see anything about enforcing Bill 4002, the amendments to Measure 110. And in fact, Jessica Vega Peterson's aide has come out specifically, and or at least they've got her saying, we don't think we need to do anything. We think people like Eli Arnold can just, as Eli explained when he came in here on his last episode, people should listen to that. We think people like Eli Arnold can just pick people up for doing drugs around Portland, drop them off somewhere that we're going to call, I don't know, we'll call it a treatment center. And they don't have to go in. They don't have to, let alone complete treatment. And that's all they have to do. And so as Eli would say, okay, and then what, they just sit there right outside there smoking fentanyl and there's nothing I can do because they're literally at the treatment center? Or they go two blocks down and maybe this isn't a neighborhood and somebody calls again and I pick them up and I drive them another two blocks and that's all I'm doing? So, I mean, it's tricky. I guess, Mike, I'm not giving you a very good question because I'm just, all these things are swirling around in my head. There's so much to do, as you know better than I do, of course. You're running. But how are you going to deal with Multnomah County? Because if you're a recovery person, you know that Multnomah County is in charge of homelessness, addiction medicine. Most people don't know this. They think this is all Ted Wheeler's fault. And I mean, there are ways we can pin it, and we can talk about things like the check to the Joint Office of Homeless Services, et cetera, but the county is really, according to the charter, in charge of spending our city money and our county tax dollars. The city of Portland is within Multnomah County on things that you, it sounds like, are a priority for you.
Sure. So, great topic of conversation here. And I guess I think the way I would approach this to begin with is Josh Barrow, one of my favorite political pundits to read, who is a very much a centrist and very practical in his orientation with regard to how he thinks about stuff like this. And he has talked about the difference between the way President Obama approached governing and the way President Biden has approached governing. And one of the key distinctions is that President Obama would release his priorities, the congressional Republicans would respond. And President Obama would respond in kind by trying to move the Republicans in line with what his priorities are. By contrast, what we've seen from the Biden administration is that they release what their priorities are. We hear from the congressional Republicans, and there is this very quick effort to identify areas of overlap between what is a priority. And that is, I would argue, why we've seen a lot of productivity from this White House. We've come together on things like infrastructure, things like the Inflation Reduction Act. And we have, I think, just a different approach now than we did during the last Democratic administration. So, kind of dovetailing with how that might look locally, treatment is widely supported. I mean, there are people out there that maybe don't have a very positive attitude towards it, but they are greatly outnumbered by those of us who understand how important it is. So if we start from the premise that we need to expand pathways to addiction treatment services, recovery support services, that is how you can start to have productive conversations between the city and the county and other stakeholders, including providers and the state, CCOs, who are the payers in this big framework. And from there, we need to talk about how do we come together around these shared priorities and make them happen. So to your point about 4002, this is really what has us at a critical moment as a community, because the state, through Measure 110 reform and House Bill 4002, is forcing the city and the county to work together. I mean, the Joint Office of Homeless Services, that agreement between the city and the county was this voluntary coming together. But 4002 is the state telling us we need to work together. And yes, the county does have the lion's share of the funding for behavioral health, public health, and they are taking lead, or they do take lead on treatment services provision. But under 4002, the city is the input into this new framework. And what I mean by that is first responders, law enforcement have this new tool. Deflection, right, is this new term that we're all learning.
Yeah, but like Eli would say, he can't use that tool in Multnomah County.
Right. Well, this is rolling out in real time. It goes into effect on September 1st. And what we need is a system where he has that tool available to
him. How do you mm-hmm. plan to get that for him on city council? And can you?
Yes. And what my plan is, we need a coordinated office of addiction response. What does that mean?
County, city?
County, city, state, providers, payers, people who work in prevention.
And then are you envisioning an actual decision maker like Jessica Vega Peterson, the chair who sets the agenda that everybody votes on, being involved in that?
So what is really crucial is that there's a shared philosophy on governance, and that is going to require city leaders and the county leaders, including the chair, being able to take recommendations and professional advice from this new table. And let me.
I mean, have you seen the county budget? Have you seen it? Have you gone through it?
Yeah.
I think you're going to have a big challenge here ideologically about including that in a philosophy with the chair. A philosophy that's worthy of consideration and funding.
So, again, I want to go back to areas of shared priority. And I am confident that all of our leaders locally agree that people who want treatment should be able to access it. And
I don't know. I don't know that that's right. Because if we wanted to, like, for instance, in this budget, we already know that, like, I think there's three, actually through Measure 110 money, I think the people who brought us 110 saw the writing on the wall towards the very, 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 very end and right before 4002, which amended Measure 110 and recriminalized drugs, slid through the legislature. They opened up, my understanding is, a third detox center. But prior to that, we had two. And three isn't enough, you know this. And nobody can get treatment if they want it. And if people, and I think this is why Sharon Myron and Julia Broome Edwards had an issue with that budget. If they wanted to, they could have put that in there. That could have been in that, what, almost $5 billion with a B now, mm-hmm. dollar budget? Mm-hmm. But it wasn't. So I don't think getting people treatment if they want it is a priority in Multnomah County. That was Julia's issue. She gave a... I did a little spot on Twitter about it. I mean, she specifically talked about it. She said, all I'm seeing is harm reduction. And I'm sure that's a piece of the continuum here. Mm-hmm. But I am not hearing one mm-hmm. word about treatment.
Mm-hmm. So separate and apart from the budget, I wanted to talk about this great article that was in the Oregonian yesterday that talked about what we learned from this 90-day emergency around the fentanyl crisis that just came to an administrative conclusion. One of the things that some of the data that has come out is that we have seen providers actually add beds over the course of the past few months. And look, I want to be clear, we do not have nearly enough beds.
Oh my gosh. Three rehab and detoxes? No. Actually, just three detoxes as far as I know. There are people lined up. You've seen this.
Yep.
They're lined up around the corner every flipping day. And we're talking about people that just want to go there voluntarily.
Right.
They should be able to get those. Why isn't that the emergency?
Right. Well, and that's so I was just having this conversation with somebody who works in behavioral health. And yes, we lack sufficient beds. We need more. Oregon has the second highest addiction rate in the country, and we're 50th in terms of access to treatment.
That's exactly right.
But the person I was having this conversation with really made the point that there are available beds. And when
where?
That's the problem. And so if you and I want to,
why can't people get them?
Well, because we have a fragmented system and everyone is siloed.
Where are these beds?
So, this is in the Oregonian article yesterday. There are different providers who have added beds recently. It's the challenge for getting folks paired with a bed is nobody knows how to go and navigate this patchwork system, especially someone who is in crisis, and get the help they need. So what we ought to be striving for is a system where we have treatment on demand, where you can go to, like, if you or I want to book a flight or a hotel room, you enter the dates, you enter where you want to leave from, you enter where you want to go. That type of accessibility is what we ought to be striving for. What I think we can work on is this getting everyone more on the same page. And Mayor Wheeler, in his remarks about what they learned from this 90-day fentanyl emergency, was how beneficial it was to have everybody working together, kind of reading off of the same sheet of music, instead of this siloed, fragmented system where people are certainly working, but they are not necessarily working in cooperation and actively communicating with others in the system. And I guess to a broader point, this is how I think about addiction and the addiction crisis and what we ought to be focusing on as people interested in solving this crisis. So if you think of a continuum, number one, you want to prevent addiction before it happens. Beyond that, when someone is actively ill and suffering from addiction, you want to intervene and interrupt it. Third, you want to treat them. And fourth, you want to help them recover and create a recovery program that is sustainable and folks can get to that point where their addiction is in remission and they can go on to live happy, self-directed lives. So I know you wanted to touch on the role intervention plays, so let me put it...
Yeah, but first of all, I guess the question, Tony, is what, if anything, can you do to bring the county to the table,
mm-hmm.
which so far they've, I would say, refused to do. I don't think this is ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a willful ideological difference. And I'm not saying it's evil. I'm actually not. I think Jessica Vega Peterson thinks she's doing the right thing. And I think the people at Multnomah County Health, in listening to them answer questions from Julie Brumovers, I think they think they're doing the right thing. I think they think, look, we're preventing the spread of disease. That's the goal. And, you know, obviously Julia's concern is, where is the treatment? Where is the recovery? Let's build it in. Can we please just, can we include this? Can we start bringing that into the fold? Mm-hmm. And so my question is, what can you do? I mean, you're talking about bringing people from county mm-hmm. to the table to focus on recovery, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. How do you, Sharon and Julie will come willingly, but that's not helpful to us because they're there and we can't get anything done mm-hmm. still at county. Nothing's happening. And that is Sharon, Myron, and Julie remembers his frustrations. And I understand it. They're outvoted on this kind of stuff every time. And elections might change that. I don't really know. I mean, that's why I think we need people like Vadim Mazursky and frankly, Sam Adams. But that's neither here nor there. I guess the question is, what can you on city council do mm-hmm. to bring somebody in from Multnomah County who can actually do something? Like, it would have to be Jessica Vega Peterson, I think. Mm-hmm. So how do you build that bridge so that there's an understanding of why recovery should be funded?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I think when we're talking about this new framework around House Bill 4002, it's important to recognize that this is something that was crafted at the state level with bipartisan support that passed both chambers of the legislature with near universal support, and then was signed into law by Governor Kotak. So there is a lot of investment at the state level where our leaders in Salem want to see deflection and House Bill 4002 succeed. And I am very confident in Governor Kotak wanting to make sure people who have access to treatment get it. So I think that it, Kristen, to your question, it's going to be a combination of things. I think that the more elected leaders hear from their constituents about something being an issue, they do respond.
When will that happen? Because it's been years now.
It has been a long time, but I would say that 4002 is really a turning point. Because
it hasn't been for the county. And I think that's what's alarming to all of us.
Sure. And I think, though, as we approach September 1st and then from September through the end of the year when decriminalization comes to a conclusion, we are going to be in this situation where there is a lot more attention on the need to make this work, and there will be more input from leaders in Salem who want to make sure the new framework they came up with, the new funding they offered up to make it work, is impactfully moving things in the right direction.
But what can they do? I mean, I saw Dan Rayfield's letter and I really appreciated it. Mm-hmm. But as far as I know, Dan can't enforce this. Dan can't make Jessica Vega Peterson do anything.
Well,
he's a legislator.
Sure. With regard to deflection, we are going to need to demonstrate success locally if we hope to receive.
And deflection is what we used to call drug court, to be clear. It's an alternative to incarceration.
It is. There's some slight differences, I think, that make it distinct from drug court because it's...
Well, we used to call it diversion. Anyway, I have no idea where these new terms are coming from. And I think they're confusing and detrimental because people understand diversion. Nobody gets deflection. It just sounds like a more word salad garbage. But that's what we're calling it now. That's fine. Diversion, deflection. The legislature can't enforce their own laws. And if the county is saying what they're saying, which is we don't read it that way, you know, there may be civil avenues for individuals mm-hmm. to force the county to enforce it. But I don't think the legislature can make them do anything.
So, I mean, the legislature, the lever they have to pull on with anything, and this is just government in general, is funding. And if the county expects to receive continued funding around behavioral health needs, for example, the state is in a position to say, well, this deflection model that you've stood up is not doing what we all needed it to do. So,
well, and let's pretend that they have the guts to pull the lever. Maybe they can, what would it be, the budget committee or whomever is deciding that package that the county ends up with pulls that. It has the guts enough to just cut them off. I mean, the city hasn't been able to do it. You know, the only person who's been willing to cut off the county at the city level is Mingus Maps, and he was outvoted by everybody else. So, I don't know. We'll see. I don't think anybody has the guts to take money away from Multnomah County, but we'll see. We'll see. But, Tony, like, what can you do on city council to get Jessica Vega Peterson at the table to talk about recovery and not just talk about it, but wrap it in to funding?
Sure. I mean, I think one piece of the conversation we've left out up to this point is that we have a new DA in Multnomah County taking office in...
Right, Nathan Vasquez.
In January. And under this new framework, the DA's office plays a very critical role in managing case flow because... I agree the terminology around everything that's happening. If you don't work in law or behavioral health, they can seem kind of confusing. So just unpackaging that a little bit. So deflection is this term for if somebody is encountered by a police officer, and let's say they're smoking fentanyl in public, the officer now has the ability to say, how about instead of taking you to booking, we take you to get assessed and referred for treatment?
Yeah, they have a choice.
Right. So that all has to be tracked, and all of that has to go through the DA's office.
Yeah.
So...
But I've seen the... I mean, I know what Nathan's inheriting. I've seen the DA's budget, and there's nothing in the DA's budget that incorporates any of this either. Nothing. And he wasn't demanded to include it. That's the other crazy thing.
Well, right, and that's where I was going with this. Initially, of course, the reporting was that Nathan wasn't included in these conversations about how to stand up deflection and make it work. But since that initial reporting came out, Nathan has joined that table, and that's progress. So, I mean, to your question, how do you get the county on board to be more supportive of expanding access to treatment services and pathways to addiction recovery? The kind of frustrating answer is it takes time and it takes pressure. And pressure can come from different players, and that includes constituents, showing up for county commissioner meetings, giving testimony, writing letters. It can come from other elected officials, both at the city, and this is something I fully intend to do, continue to talk about the need to expand access to treatment. And it's going to come from officials at the state who are going to have to remind us that 4002 will not succeed unless local leaders come together and make it work. So I am going to circle back to what I said initially, and I do believe that most people want treatment available for people who want treatment. So I think when you start from that premise, you have a real opportunity to build a coalition.
But I mean, that's a year away, is it not? Because then, we need a new budget cycle so that we can incorporate that.
So, look, that's a long-term question. And absolutely. In the meantime, we do have an emergency, and we do have to find ways to reach more people. With regard to the
budget...
What
would you do to reach more people?
So I think
as a city councilor.
So the city is actually doing some really great things. With the Fire Bureau, we know that they are offering buprenorphine to folks now and giving them transportation to places like Central City Concern. We have more outreach workers collaborating or starting to collaborate with Portland Police. That is the type of thing that the city has more control over because it's their bureaus. And the city, through being the lead form of government that deals with first responders, can do a lot. And to your point, long term, we have to have these conversations around the budget to reconfigure things that emphasize and prioritize treatment.
And then, you know, we were going to talk about intervention and does it work? And I appreciated that question, that direction, because mm-hmm. I do think we should talk about it. There are people, I think, who supported the decriminalization of drugs who argue intervention doesn't work. People have to decide on their own mm-hmm. that they want to seek recovery. And so we should not be having law enforcement or other governmental means of intervention. I think they would say certainly not law enforcement, because addiction is a medical issue mm-hmm. and it is not a criminal issue, and we should not be stigmatizing it. And you know the arguments, but mm-hmm. I think another one of their arguments is that intervention just doesn't work, and they'll say they have data to support that. And so what are your mm-hmm. thoughts about, as a recovering, somebody in recovery, mm-hmm. what are your thoughts about intervention? I think
sure.
the question is, particularly since you've been endorsed by the police union, from a law enforcement perspective.
Mm-hmm. I'm happy to take that on. Some good talking points there. So number one, let's start with this idea that we have to categorize the addiction crisis. It's either public health or public safety. I want to be very clear about this. It's both. There are certainly medical and public health issues going on around addiction, 100%. But also, it presents public safety challenges. And you can think about it like this. Addiction is a family disease, and I don't just mean that it's hereditary, which of course it is. But when you have someone who's suffering from addiction, everyone in their house is suffering with them. Even if the people they're living with aren't themselves suffering from addiction, they are living with what it's like to live with someone who is in crisis. And you can, I think, reasonably expand that into a community level. So, I mean, folks who work downtown, even if they are not people who struggle from addiction, they are significantly impacted by the addiction crisis.
Well, here we are. Yes. I mean, you got here today. I'm certain you saw a few things that...
I have, like many Portlanders, I mean, had the experience of walking through downtown with my young kids and seeing people using fentanyl, having just finished or getting ready to start using fentanyl. It's everywhere. And in that regard, the public, the community at large, has a say in how we ought to be responding to the addiction crisis, because they're affected by it as well. And that is how public safety, I think, needs to be considered in this problem solving around how we approach this. Is addiction a public health issue? 100%. And that goes back to my point about making sure that we have to have treatment available for those who need it and want it. And then where I'm going with this is you need a bridge built from people who are behavioral health professionals who deal with the medical piece and public safety professionals, people like Portland Police Bureau, people like Portland Fire and Rescue. They are the ones on the front lines who are reviving people from fentanyl overdoses. And I know part of what is so frustrating for them is they're not able to get people plugged into resources fast enough at a rate which this crisis demands. So intervention, your question about intervention, is it an important tool? Yes.
Well, and I think, does it work? Is there data to support it? Well, is there data to support law enforcement being involved, in your opinion?
Yes, there is. I mean, intervention in a general sense, we know that fentanyl is extraordinarily lethal, and we know that Portland's drug supply is contaminated with fentanyl. It's everywhere. And when we talk about intervention, I think just on a very fundamental level, stopping somebody and disrupting ongoing drug use is preventing a potential poisoning. I mean, that is very basic public safety. And intervention is also an opportunity where there is this encounter between law enforcement or a family member or a coworker, where you can have this serious conversation with somebody and say, is this really what you want? I mean, do you want to try something different? And we know that that is much more effective than just allowing people to slowly continue to hurt themselves over and over again. And kind of moving one step further down the spectrum, there's this idea around compelling treatment versus only providing treatment when it's entirely voluntary. And I think the data that is interesting is that if you look at pilots who are referred to treatment, for example, and they're told, if you want to continue to be able to fly, you have to get some help with your addiction issue. And we have data that shows that that's very effective because, again, consequences or the possibility of consequences does play a role in successful recovery. More generally, when we're talking about doing policy, policy really is, it comes down to incentivizing or disincentivizing certain behaviors, right? So one example is like seatbelts. We want everyone to wear seatbelts because it's very clear that they save lives. So if you don't wear one, you get a ticket. And you can take that same concept into what we're talking about. And that is where this debate around undoing decriminalization and introducing this new approach of House Bill 4002 to provide that external pressure to encourage people to get help they need. I think as somebody in recovery, knowing how effective that external nudge can be, it helps me in terms of thinking about what policy is going to be most impactful with regard to getting people connected with treatment.
And what do you think is most impactful?
I think that you do, in many cases, need that external, I mean, it's carrot and stick is what it comes down to. And what I like about 4002 is that while the justice system is involved, and I know that that's an issue for some folks who don't like it, it creates an opportunity for people to have the entire involvement of the justice system removed from their record if they participate in treatment and recovery. So that is that system of incentive and disincentive. The incentive is, hey, if I do this, I don't have to worry about a record. And the disincentive is, if I don't do the treatment route, I'm going to get stuck with all these court dates and a record, and I really don't want to have to do that. I think that that plays a key role in helping people get connected with the services they need.
Now, you talked about a protest that you were involved with, and I didn't get questions for you about that protest, but I did get questions about your feelings about the 2020, I think most people in the city will call them riots. I guess the first question is, what are your thoughts on what the 180 plus nights in 2020?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, going back to what I described, the coming out and marching peacefully in response to Roe v. Wade being overturned, and there was not any destruction of property. There was not hurling items at police officers or first responders. What I was doing was political expression and political speech. And what you're describing, and more recently what we saw happen down at Portland State, that's not speech. Destruction of private property is criminal behavior. And to the extent people are upset about something, they have every right to express themselves in peaceful ways. They can write things. They can participate in marches. And that is as American as it gets. But when we're talking about setting fires or doing upwards of $1 million worth of damage at Portland State, that's a different ballgame. It's criminal behavior and ought to be treated as such.
And do you feel the same way about the Portland State takeover of the library?
Well, yeah. I mean, when people are barricading themselves in Portland State's library, and the figures I've seen is between $750,000 and $1 million worth of damage, that is not an acceptable way of expressing how you feel about world events. And people have every right to develop their own opinion about what is happening here locally around political issues they care about, or what's happening in Gaza. But what they don't get to do is $1 million worth of damage to one of our public institutions.
Why did you run for city council, Tony?
Sure. Well,
talk to us about that.
So, I mean, Kristen, I'm running for Portland City Council because Portland has an addiction crisis, and I believe very strongly that we need a recovery champion in City Hall to solve it. And I think that I get this question a lot, and for me, it comes back to part of the recovery journey for a lot of us is looking for ways to be of service to others. How do I pass on what was so freely given away to me? And I am not wired to be a drug and alcohol counselor or somebody who is doing peer mentor services. But I think what I have to offer people who are struggling with addiction is a voice in and around government to help craft and move policy that helps people who are suffering. And that is really what's driving me.
But why city council? Why channel that into public office?
Mm-hmm. I think that for me, my experience working as...
And I guess why not county? Mm-hmm. You know, if you're into recovery... Like, normally I would say, well, why not Multnomah County? I mean, that's where you want to go if you want to focus on recovery.
Well, so number one, I would say that my experience working in government relations and as the policy director at Oregon Recovers, I saw firsthand just how impactful elected leaders, the work they do is around issues like this. I think that you can really reach the most amount of people in need through policymaking. And I am really drawn to the ability to make impactful decisions for people who are suffering in this crisis. To your question about why the city, well, I think that the city needs to be more of an elevated player in how we respond to the addiction crisis. And we've been talking a lot about this relationship between the city and the county. And in order for us to get our arms around this crisis, you need people who understand this issue both at the city and the county. You need people who are focused on recovery on both sides of the river who are ready to work together on this issue. So Commissioner Brim Edwards is doing great work. So I feel like I can be impactful by working with her as a member of City Council. And I think that the more we have everyone at all layers of government, both locally and at the state level, working off of the same plan, the same coordinated approach to solving this crisis, the better off we're going to be.
Just to finish up, I really appreciate your time here. Is there anything else you think people should know that we've talked about a lot, we've covered a lot of ground, but what else should people know that we haven't talked about?
Sure. I would direct folks, if they want to learn more about my campaign, to tonyforportland.com. You can read about my platform, a little bit more about myself, why I'm running. You can see my list of endorsements, and that includes Nathan Vasquez. I've been endorsed by over 10 labor organizations. I have a lot of labor support. I have supporters from the business community, and that's all available on my website. And if anyone listening wants to submit a comment to me directly, they can do so through the website as well.
Thank you, Tony. Tony Morris, running for City Council District 4.
Thanks, Kristen.